We are in Proverbs 30. We are looking at these words of Agur and kind of a different style of proverbial writing a little bit, particularly in the sections we're going to be looking at where he does a lot of grouping things together. But we start with verse 17. And verse 17, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out. And the young eagles will eat it. Now, I think the idea of the eye scorning or mocking the parent might be the idea of rolling your eyes at somebody. You know, kind of like in a disdainful, mocking sort of a way, kind of a oh brother kind of a way, but perhaps with the idea of really mocking the parents. And, of course, we understand from Proverbs, as well as from other passages, that respect for parental authority is fundamental in God's arrangement, that when we don't respect the authority of our parents, we're really not respecting the authority of the Lord, because he's the one who put the parents in charge. And so there's a severe punishment. Imagine the ravens picking out the eye and the eagles eating it. Boy, if that was the punishment for that, I suspect it would put a stop to any of those kinds of mockeries very quickly, don't you imagine? And then he says in verse 18, there are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Now, that's interesting, but really difficult to try to explain what we're looking at there. For one thing, we're looking at the limitations of human wisdom. Even when you're wise, there are things that are hard to explain. So you've got that aspect. But what's the common denominator between those four and verse 19? I can think of a lot of options. I'm not sure the best option. In some cases, you think about, you know, movement that leaves no trace. You know, you can take an eagle in the sky, there's no trail. You can take a serpent on a rock and you don't see anything left behind. You know, it doesn't leave a trail in the dirt or something like that. Ship in the middle of the sea, as soon as it goes past, the sea's back calm again, the way of a man with a maiden. Maybe there's nothing you can really tell afterwards. Or maybe it's like the grace and ease and the mastery over difficult elements to negotiate, like the air or the rock or the sea. Or maybe it's the idea of wonder. Here's a heavy bird that can stay in the air without falling, and a serpent that can move without the aid of wings or of feet, and a heavy thing that can sail on the water without sinking. And so maybe these are just wonders, you know, amazing things in the way of a man with a maiden. There's some other possibilities, so I'm just threw some out. I don't know. I really don't know what the common denominator is. I think I understand verse 20 better. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. You know, isn't that the way of sinners with their sin? You know, you involve yourself in something even like this, as intimate as the sexual union, improper sexual union, and then walk away from the encounter like no harm, no foul. You know, no pang of conscience, no further thought. You know, everything's fine, nothing ever really happened. You know, doesn't leave any bigger impression than eating a meal. You know, you think about, what did you have for lunch last Tuesday? I don't know what I had for lunch last Tuesday. You know, I'm sure it was good. You know, we don't really, you know, we eat a lot, we eat all the time, and unless there's some particular reason to remember a meal, most all the meals we've ever eaten, we don't really remember. And so it's like she just has no conscience. She can just go about her activities and doesn't faze her. You know, satisfying her appetite for men is no different than satisfying her food appetite in her mind. She just wipes her mouth, says ho-hum, and denies she's ever done anything wrong. Isn't that the problem we have in our society? Is this very great tendency to just rationalize things that we do wrong. Just kind of, misdeeds, we just kind of assume that everything's fine. And, you know, we just try to deny. We try to justify. We try not to let it bother us. And so with this adulteress, there's a horrifying lack of remorse. She just doesn't ever really come to grips with the seriousness of the sin. Think about your sins. And so often, our problem is it doesn't really bother us. You know, our conscience is not loud enough. The story of the little boy who said, you know, God make the little voice loud. That's what we need, is a loud little voice in our mind saying, that was wrong. And that's a serious matter. When we get to where we can sin and it's just like, oh, well, you know, it's just like kind of eating another meal. No big deal. That's when we're really in trouble. That's when our conscience is being seared. Our heart is being hardened. And that's a wake-up call if there ever was one. Then look at verse 21. Under three things the earth quakes, and under four it cannot bear up. Under a slave when he becomes king, and a fool when he is satisfied with food. Under an unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. Now, I think the idea is that sometimes in society, people leave the role that they're accustomed to, and they get into a position of a place that they're not really able to handle. You promote a person who's had a very low social status and promote them to be the boss, the supervisor, the head. And a lot of times they become pretentious and arrogant and pretty much unbearable because they're not used to having that power. They're not used to having that dignity, and often they abuse it. You think about a Nabal, a fool who actually became rich and powerful, and he was just terrible. You know, the worst thing you can have is you promote a fool and make them a ruler. Luxury is not fitting for a fool, much less for a slave to rule over princes. That's Proverbs 19:10. And so you take these people, a slave becoming a king, wow, that's probably not going to be a good thing. You know, a fool, feeding a fool to where he's satisfied, hard telling what he's going to lash out at. An unloved woman when she gets a husband, or a maidservant when she takes over. Think about Hagar and Sarah. And so a lot of times people moving out of their sphere and their realm into something they can't handle. I think that's the idea. And then look at verse 24. This is a little bit easier maybe in some ways, very practical. Four things are small on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. The Shephanim are not mighty people, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. The lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. So here's the unexpected success of small animals. You wouldn't expect any great accomplishment from animals that are this insignificant. These are creatures that don't demand attention. They're not very big. They're not very mighty. But wisdom does not require a lot of physical strength or size. They can still accomplish great things, and we can learn from them. So go back and look at these four. Think about the ant. The ant isn't a strong people. But wow, there are ants everywhere, and you look and think about what ants do. They store up the food for the winter. They provide for the future. And so they, in the good times, they're always storing up for the bad times. That's a great attitude for us. We need to be preparing for the future. Think about spiritually. You know, we need to think about, what am I doing now to strengthen myself for future challenges? We need to be studying and praying and working to improve ourselves. You know, think about when maybe we're kind of at a lull, we're not being tempted greatly, we're not going through a lot of difficult circumstances, that may just be given to us so we can prepare for the next onslaught, so we can get stronger to face the next temptation that'll be more difficult. And you also think about the ant just being such a busy people, busy animals. You know, they're always working hard, and that's what we need to be. I mean, if the ants are able to survive, and I'll tell you what, they're everywhere. There are ants in Brazil. There were ant hills way taller than this building in Mozambique. They're all over the place. I mean, being so small and sort of insignificant, they're incredible. It's the lesson of working hard, investing in the future, you know, not being lazy, but being diligent. So we learn a lot from the little ants. The Shephanim are like little badgers. And they're not mighty people, but they make their houses in the rocks. So they recognize that they're weak, and they take refuge in something strong, which is what we need to do. We need to recognize we're weak, apart from the Lord, and take refuge in Him. Trust in Him as our rock. Our rock. You know, try to cling closer to Him and you know, put our faith and trust in Him. Sometimes we can look at ourselves and we can feel how small we are, how not very talented we are. And instead of seeing that as a challenge, okay, I'm going to have to find security. I'm going to have to find a rock like the Lord. We just kind of feel sorry for ourselves. And oh, poor me, I didn't get dealt a very good hand. You know, I've got to go through really difficult circumstances. Well, make the best use of what you have. That may make you even more aware of how much you depend on the Lord. And so turn to Him. That's really the lesson in those things. Don't bemoan, oh, I'm so small, I'm so insignificant, I don't really make a difference, I don't have very much talent. Do what these Shephanim do, make your house in the rock. Use the situation you've got to turn to the Lord and trust in Him. Then the locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. So you think about how the locusts, like a grasshopper, I mean, not very big, not very mighty, but they're united. They go in a swarm and they just devastate everything. That teamwork, that unity, that discipline of working together, each playing a role. They're a fierce war machine, but each individually, they're all small and insignificant. So you think about how we need to be united and work together, and in the common work in the body, each building each other up and strengthening where the other one's weak, together we can accomplish great things for the Lord. That's what He intends. He doesn't intend for us to be lone rangers. You take a lone locust out here who goes rogue, he won't be able to do anything. But together with the swarm, they can do great things. And then the lizard, you can grasp him with the hands. A little lizard, you know, we used to have them all over the place in Brazil. They come in the house, you can't stop them, they're everywhere. And just scampering up the walls, but they're little bitty things. You know, I'm not talking about, at least in Brazil, and I assume here, not some great big, you know, chameleon or something, but just a little lizard. But it's amazing. They're in king's palaces. Here it's the value of persistent ambition. They keep working at it, and they get where they want to be. They're not necessarily so talented or so strong, but they can gain access to the king, something that most of the king's subjects can't do because they're persistent, because they keep after it till they get where they want to be. So if you look at those four small animals, you see in them lessons for us. The ant, the foresight and the hard work. The badger, seeing our weakness and taking refuge in the rock. The locust, the unity, the teamwork, the disciplined activity. And the lizard, the persistent ambition. So here are little creatures that you would think they won't amount to anything, they can't do anything, but really they do. So don't think, well, I'm so small, I'm so insignificant, poor me. Think, okay, what do I have to do to compensate for that smallness in the ways these small animals are doing? I think those are really good illustrations. You could talk a long time about each one of them. And then look at verse 29. There are three things which are stately in their march, even four which are stately when they walk. The lion, which is mighty among beasts, and does not retreat before any, the strutting rooster, the male goat also, and a king when his army is with him. So in God's order, you've got some small creatures, verses 24 to 28, and then you've got some more prominent ones. And here are animals that are stately, that are noble, that have a poise and kind of a royal bearing to them. And you can see that with the lion, king of the beasts, the rooster, maybe smaller, but, you know, he certainly is not bashful. The male goat, you know, is strong and, you know, very independent. And the king, when he's got his army with him. And so it's the idea of creatures that are kind of the leader in their own realms and that hold their head up. And maybe the idea is the child of God ought to show a royal manner, avoiding things that degrade him spiritually, but continuing to live like a child of the king, someone who's from noble birth and noble blood, having that connection with God, and so acting in a spiritually noble way. And then look at verse 32. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have plotted evil, put your hand on your mouth. For the churning of milk produces butter, and pressing the nose brings forth blood, so the churning of anger brings strife. There's a colorful comparison. But you start with the importance of humility. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, you realize you've kind of overreached. You know, don't make things worse. We destroy relationships when we constantly seek to exalt ourselves, always thinking about ourselves, promoting ourselves. You know, the kind of guy who's always trying to, you know, push his way to the head of the line, physically or otherwise. Don't do that. You know, if you do that, stop it. That's a foolish thing. Often it's better to take our losses and lose face even and admit, no, I don't belong here, or I've been promoting myself too much. If you plotted evil, you know, if you plotted something that's not right, stop it. You know, here are things that once you realize where you're at, repent, turn back. You know, churning milk produces butter, pressing the nose brings blood, and churning anger brings strife. You think about how many times just giving vent to our anger and frustration just leads to fighting and quarreling and strife. How many times do we have a hard time not being the guy who gets the last word in the discussion? You know, we want to be the one that gets our word in last. You know, and you know, just we kind of become troublemakers. You know, we want to make sure we get our way. And we just, we can't let it go. You know, there are times for us to talk honestly, frankly, about disagreements. You know, I don't think that's right. I don't sit that way. But the idea is just pushing it and pressing it. You know, okay, we've discussed it. We understand where we stand, at least. We don't agree. Move on. No, I've got to convince you. I've got to make sure you're on my side. I've got to make sure you knew I was right all along. You know, I've got to make sure you give in on every detail of how I see something. You see people who do that. They've just got to push it. It's going to create problems. That's the thing that creates strife and difficulty. Trouble will follow the people who create trouble. You know, and we kind of reap what we sow in that. So thoughtful ideas in that chapter. Then look at chapter 31. You've got the words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. There are occasional, though not common, words from women in the Bible. You see in early Proverbs several statements to listen to your mother. And this is the King Lemuel listening to his mother. You see things like Hannah's song, Mary's song in Luke chapter 1, Deborah and Barak's song in Judges chapter 5, and so forth. So we've got a handful of examples, just not a whole lot. But this is what she taught her son. So he was a king, and she gives advice to him. What, O my son, and what, O son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows? So evidently she made vows before she even had him, And perhaps she made a vow like Hannah to dedicate himself to the Lord. And so she says, what do I have to say to you? What do I need to tell you here? Well, she warns him about some things. Do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. So warning about sexual temptation. Don't compromise your moral integrity. Don't get involved with women. That's things that destroy kings. It's not appropriate for this last week or two in politics. I mean, wow, isn't it amazing how misdeeds in the past come back to haunt people? You know, so many times when somebody's, you know, their career in politics or in other areas is just going up, up, and up, and then comes to find out all the things they've done that have been wrong come back to derail them and just ruin people's careers, ruin people's lives. She's giving him good advice. You know, don't give your strength to women. You know, there's that idea of a king. He can do what he wants to. A king is powerful. You know, probably a king gets a whole lot of people, you know, trying to please him, trying to be make him happy with them. So it's easy for a king to get to think that every woman in the world wants him and that he's just really a wonderful catch and he may, you know, give his ways and his strength to women and his ways to that which destroys kings. That's unwise. So she's giving him good advice there, warning him about sexual temptation. Then look at verse 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink. For they will drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. So she says, Lemuel, don't drink because it affects your memory and your judgment. It's a lot like immorality in impairing your thinking. There's an interesting passage in Hosea that says that. In Hosea 4:11, harlotry, wine and new wine take away the understanding. That's Hosea 4:11. Harlotry, wine and new wine take away the understanding. Interesting connection. You know, alcohol and immorality will make you do stupid things. They'll impair your judgment. You will act under the influence. You can be under the influence of immorality in a way, like you would be under the influence of alcohol. You won't make a good decision as a king. A king shouldn't be drinking. You know, you think about Ben-Hadad in 1 Kings 20, who got whipped in a war that he should have won because he was drunk. Think about Belshazzar in Daniel 5, who was drunk. You think about Herod, who made that extremely foolish commitment to his stepdaughter. A whole lot of bad things about that, but he was evidently drunk a little much and offered her up to half his kingdom. Good thing she didn't ask for that since he didn't really have a kingdom to give her anyway. But kings need to know what they're doing. You know, what kings decide has ramifications for a whole lot of people. You get a drunk king. Wow. Hard telling what he'll mess up and how many serious consequences there'll be. So rulers aren't people you want to forget and use poor judgment. She says, I'll tell you what strong drink's good for. Give it to the one who's perishing. You know, isn't that kind of what we do? You know, I mean, somebody's dying, put them on morphine or something to just kind of knock them out till they go so they won't feel the pain. That's what that's good for. You know, that's kind of a sarcastic thing she's saying. You know, well, there's some good for alcohol. Give it to the person who's perishing, who has no hope, no life, no future, or no anything. That's what that's good for. Knock them out and keep them, you know, in a stupor or whatever. Clearly, you wouldn't want strong drink for anybody who wants to think straight, anybody who needs to exercise any kind of judgment or make any kind of decisions or act in any responsible way. Give it to the one who's perishing, whose life is bitter, and he'll drink and forget all his troubles. You know, he won't even know what's going on. So that's kind of a sarcastic way of saying, certainly a king wouldn't want to be messing around with alcohol. You know, because the king's trying to make good judgments and lead a country. So she warns about those two things, sexual temptation and alcohol. Very wise statements to a king, but really to any child of God. We need to watch out for those things that impair our judgment and cause us to act foolishly. And then look at verse 8. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and needy. Now there's the role of a king, the role of a leader. We've seen it before in Proverbs, to stand up for justice for the oppressed, champion the rights of the poor and the needy, the people who cannot otherwise get a fair hearing. You know, there's a lot of people who would think of kings as their goal is just to perpetuate their power, or to be able maybe to make a lot of money, or to show how powerful they are. But really, God's intention is that governmental leadership is based upon righteousness and justice. And the goal is not to exalt themselves or to get rich or whatever. The goal is to benefit the oppressed, to bring justice and righteousness for the vulnerable. You know, so opening your mouth for the mute, the unfortunate, the afflicted, and the needy. There's so much of a temptation when you've got a leadership role to focus on the privileges of being the king and not the responsibilities. Oh, look! I'm king now. I can do whatever I want to. I can make everybody serve me. Can't you imagine that being the mindset? And you can see it in the Bible of some of the bad kings there were who that's exactly what they were trying to do. They were trying to just exalt themselves and get their own way. They were ruler for their own benefit. But that's not God's intention. And really, this would be true not only of kings, but people in leadership positions in business and so forth. We need to be doing that in a way that maintains justice and righteousness, and especially caring for those who don't have the clout to speak effectively for themselves. A king, a governmental leadership, especially needs to watch out for the vulnerable and those that can be taken advantage of and bring justice to bear in that case. God's very clear about what the role even of government is. And these words of advice from King Lemuel's mother really would be excellent words for any ruler of any kind to read and think about and meditate on, and for all of us, really. I mean, our goal, to whatever extent we have influence, is to stand up for the rights of those who are unjustly treated and make sure that we treat them fairly and try to get others to do the same. Which leads us then to the very last section of Proverbs, which we'll work on the next time we talk on Sunday night. Very interesting section. I'll just give you a teaser about that, a couple of things that I think are worth thinking about, and maybe you can look at it ahead of time. First of all, did you know that this last section of Proverbs is an acrostic poem? Every verse starts with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet, just like Psalm 119, or other psalms, most of Lamentations and so forth. So this psalm has 22 verses. All 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet are represented. But the thing that I think you see in this poem, or whatever you want to call it, about the worthy woman, is really a summary of all the virtues we've had in Proverbs. So when you read this and think about it, think of this worthy woman as sort of representing the epitome of the wise person as Proverbs describes them. I think this is just a perfect ending to the book and will kind of sum up many of the things we've looked at and help us to see here's what wisdom really looks like in practice. So we'll work on this the next time we do a lesson on Sunday night. And at this time, if you need to obey the gospel, we're going to sing a song and encourage you to come forward while we stand and sing.